You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet, always here in my individual capacity. We're continuing our series this week on scaling AI and national security. And to discuss this with me is friend of the cast, Josh Geltzer, current partner at the law firm of WilmerHale, the former deputy assistant to the president and deputy homeland security advisor, former executive editor and editor of Just Security. Josh has pretty much done everything. He's even clerked for the U.S. Supreme Court. I don't know how he does it. He's just amazing. But anyway, thank you so much for coming in. I'm glad you're here.
Thank you. It is a treat to get to talk with you always, both on the podcast and off. And it's a particular treat to get to return to this. I've been looking forward to it.
All right. Well, I thought it'd be good to level set on the laws because we've talked a lot about the development of many of these companies. They're sort of what we see as spurious financial conditions right now, and whether or not they're positioned to scale or whether or not there's even usable data available at this point. Let's talk about laws, regulations, riders on AI, all of which are going to have an impact on its scaling. And I thought we could talk about this in terms also of federalism, national security, and sort of the recent events we've been watching that might suggest the future of AI is not as clear when it comes to national security, although it remains a significant NatSec concern. So let's start with the NDAA. God, that thing. Did you read it all?
I would say I read much of it and I scanned other portions of it as necessary. Is that fair?
I think that's great. And you know, you sound better than a member of Congress who might claim otherwise. So what is in there governing AI? And if you could refrain from using the term killer robots, that would be awesome. I don't want to scare our audience, unless, of course, killer robots were mentioned in the NDAA.
Not mentioned, at least in the portions I read most closely. So I think I'll be able to manage that. But let me start big picture. And I'd like to make two points. One about what's there and one about what's not there. What struck me as interesting in terms of what's there is a real grappling with AI risk as well as AI opportunity. And maybe part of the reason that's interesting is because almost exactly 12 months into the current administration, as we have this conversation, there has been a lot more emphasis from the executive branch on AI opportunity. You see this in the action plan that was issued in July, the EOs that accompanied it, other statements from the administration since. There's a real sense of boosting the U.S. private sector for further AI development, boosting U.S. government's procurement and deployment of the technology, a kind of go, go, go attitude. Not entirely. There's nuance to it, but that's the thrust of it. You read the NDAA, and there's both. There is some encouragement, urging, direction to study and in some ways use this technology, for example, by the Defense Department, but there's an acknowledgement of AI risk, both our own uses of AI and adversaries' use and deployment. So that sense of risk as well as opportunity jumps out at me from the NDAA. Then I think it's worth pointing out something that's not there that I suspect we'll come to at some point in the conversation, which is preemption, federal preemption of state-level AI laws. That's notable because it's something that some on the Hill and in the executive branch wanted to see included. They've said that explicitly after a previous effort to move preemption or moratorium failed, though barely failed over the summer. And it didn't make it into the NDAA. That doesn't mean there won't be federal preemptive law, meaning statutory law, in the months to come. But it did mean that the executive branch pivoted around the time of the NDAA and issued an executive order instead, which does much more modest, targeted things. So those are two big picture in and out reflections I have.
Well, there has to be a committee buried in there somewhere, right? There are always committees, Josh. So what committee? But there seem to be a lot of them. Committees, task force, I don't care what you call it. Something that someone's later going to put on their resume and they'll pump out a paper. What did they look like in the NDAA?
There are plenty of those in this NDAA. It's sort of become an annual tradition, it seems. And I should emphasize, when we talk about the NDAA this time, it's really two things. The Intel Auth Act, the Intelligence Authorization Act, was packaged together this year with the National Defense Authorization Act. So the NDAA includes the IAA, or Intel Auth Act, making it an even bigger behemoth and an even larger repository of task force and committees and studies and things of that nature, though many, I think, pretty consequential and serious in the AI space. So the NDAA calls on the Secretary of Defense to stand up what it describes as a cross-functional team for AI model assessment and oversight. This team needs to get stood up by June of this year, meaning 2026, and it needs to produce by June of the following year, 2027, an assessment framework. In other words, the Defense Department will have, coming out of the work of this entity, a framework for thinking about ethical principles for AI use and deployment, for where risk is highest in terms of AI use, for how the Defense Department going forward wants to procure and further augment models. That framework is, I think, a key deliverable of one of the bodies that the NDAA requires the executive branch to stand up.
That's a lot of activity that's going to have to occur. Very interesting. And in agencies, some of which haven't even been able to report their budgets. You know, that's going to be fascinating. Have we heard some of this before? This sounds vaguely familiar and like not an entirely new idea.
It sounds familiar to me as well. And that's in part because at least I see reflections here of work done over the past few years going back into the Biden administration. There was a national security memorandum on AI, NSM-25, issued by President Biden that called for development of an AI risk framework, which was then very swiftly issued. And at least as of the time you and I are having this conversation, that NSM remains on the books. It hasn't been rescinded. And that risk framework that it called for remains on the books. And so the idea of trying to demarcate or articulate what uses of AI are of particularly high risk because they directly impact human life or because they have key impacts on things we hold dear, property, job opportunities, and then to figure out what more should happen for those uses. Further testing, constraint on prompts, constraint on outputs, checked by humans. That was an exercise that we thought appropriate in establishing the framework I mentioned, and that has its kind of echoes and reflections in some work by nonprofits in this space, how the Europeans approach this issue. So there are things that are familiar there.
Let's talk about what's missing in terms of, you started to mention this, high-risk use cases. I think when people see phrases like that, I think their imagination either runs wild or they can't imagine exactly what a high-risk case would be. Can you give us some sense of what a high-risk, and broadly if you need to, but what a high-risk case be in terms of AI deployment? I may have my own ideas here, but give me some sense of what that would really be.
So many folks in this space are grappling, I wouldn't say struggling, but at least grappling with this question. You see it in, just to take a detour for a second, the law that mostly took effect at the beginning of this month that was signed into law by Governor Newsom in California late last year, focused on frontier AI and catastrophic risk, and tried in California statutory language to articulate what catastrophic risk means in the context of AI. So folks are grappling with this question of how to carve out the kind of worst of the worst that's imaginable, along with obviously many wonderful opportunities that I think the technology presents. But for those trying to make this concrete, and especially as you and I talk about the National Defense Authorization Act, we're talking about the military here. We're talking about use cases in which AI, if gone wrong, can lead to conceivably firing of weapons and loss of life, civilian life, unintended loss of life, in which it can lead to a loss of life because of malfunction in AI-controlled vehicular transport. In other words, could cost our own service members their lives as well as innocents. And even short of that, could lead through mistaken errant targeting or categorization of treating as hostile actors, detaining even those who might in fact not be hostile at all, might be doing nothing wrong. And so I don't think it's far-fetched to imagine that in the context of the military in particular, AI deployment carries many opportunities and risks of that type of quite stark nature.
I'll just give you what my imagination says in this space. And one of them is that systems fail and weapons intended to be deployed elsewhere, deployed against us, or intended not to be deployed at all, are deployed and cause significant, maybe even major catastrophic human life within the United States. So that's one potential scenario. It talks a lot about catastrophic use cases. One of the concerns that I would have vis-a-vis any use of AI is the poisoning of any model that is used or any basis the poisoning of the model would then be to me sort of the catastrophic event that would trigger a catastrophic use case. And looking at some of the white papers that have been coming out of various higher institutions, a lot of people are painting as the highest risk the problem with the data itself. You know, a transition of the model from some efficacy that we believe it has to something entirely different. So I'm going to assume, based on what you're saying, that it really doesn't come to that. There wasn't anything in the NDAA that talked about the possibility of model corruption or data poisoning.
You know, it is in there. I mean, first of all, I agree with you that the risk is real. This is a very sophisticated, elaborate form of the old saying, junk in, junk out, but essentially it's the modern form of that. And there is a piece of the NDAA that calls out in particular risks to the supply chains of such systems, meaning AI systems, including counterfeit parts or data poisoning risks. So Congress is thinking about the same potential problem that you're thinking about. And I think rightly so, in that these models are remarkable in what they can do. They are also remarkable in, at times, how little we understand about how they're able to do what they do, which really ratchets up the pressure on their training, including the data on which that training occurs, to yield outputs that we're happy with. Now, there are ways to model test before deployment. There are ways to refine. There are ways to have models supervise other models and pause outputs that seem concerning. That's not the only stage at which AI safety checks get implemented, but it's an important one. And the idea of adversarial manipulation of models can include, and indeed Congress now has said it does include, or is worth being concerned that it includes, this poisoning risk that you're bringing up.
And with respect to some of the data, I found very interesting about 3 years ago when Congress held hearings on the availability of data possessed by the Department of Defense that would sort of inform these models. And I think 85% of it was absolutely unusable. And I'm always looking in the NDAA or, you know, frankly, any bill for something that might address potentially converting that into usable data, if that's a possibility. Let's talk about the pay-for-service model prohibition in the NDAA. That just resonated as incredibly commonsensical, but why don't we explain what it is and why that actually seemed, I don't know if you agree with me, but I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me.
It is interesting. It's interesting because it relates to a question you asked before about what's similar and different between what we've just been talking about and the AI risk framework that was issued during the Biden administration coming out of NSM25's issuance. Because something that was there was a category, a list of prohibited high risk use cases. In other words, categorically off limits. Now, at least the NDAA charter for the framework that this new group at the Defense Department needs to produce, it doesn't have that as one of the ticks, as one of the bullets. Doesn't mean that the group couldn't generate that. I would think it would be within their mandate, but it isn't something Congress put its thumb on the scale and said, part of what you need to make part of this framework would be a category of things totally verboten, totally off limits. And yet we have what you've just described, which is a different section of the NDAA prohibiting the development or operating of a missile defense system with kinetic capabilities using pay-for-service models. In other words, the NDAA says that sort of thing, missile defense, is inherently governmental, and it's not okay to just subscribe to some private sector, probably relying on AI, tech for something that consequential and something that is both as important to get right and as important not to get wrong as that. And it does suggest, if you read the NDAA kind of holistically, that there are things that the sentiment of Congress, at least, would yield as kind of off limits, at least for now, the state of the technology for AI to perform.
All of this is fascinating to me. I guess what fascinated me particularly, because I did look at your write-up, and we're going to hyperlink it into the notes of the cast for people who want to take a look, because it's very digestible, it's very straightforward, and it's very helpful to people who want to see something in print. But let's talk about task forces required to be formed to study a problem and issue a scathing paper. I mean, we are inside the Beltway and we do that better than anyone, after which the paper disappears, nobody remembers. And I've been on those task forces before, which typically you have to hew pretty closely to the remit. And, you know, this would be the remit, right? Right here in the statute. What does some of these task forces that we haven't already talked about look like?
Another one that jumped out at me is a task force. I think it's labeled a task force in the NDAA that calls for the Defense Department to think through another issue that has been salient in Congress, salient in the executive branch, salient in private sector thinking on AI, which is the idea of creating sandbox environments, essentially isolated computing environments. And the basic thought is this: there is a difference between what's safe to do and play with AI to do when it's released in the wild, connected to the open internet, and accessible by everyone, versus when it is not connected to the open internet and perhaps available only to experts with security clearances. You might feel quite comfortable, or at least sufficiently comfortable, with some experiments and some testing and some augmentation in the latter that you would not at all feel comfortable in the former. I think that premise is widely agreed on. So the question then becomes, well, what do these sandboxes look like and how safe do they need to be for the benefits of experimentation to outweigh the risks? And so that's what this task force is charged with within the Defense Department. It is charged with thinking through how the Defense Department can standardize requirements for AI sandbox environments so that over time, the Defense Department has a place to kind of move in, so to speak, AI models and do things with them that might otherwise be on the unacceptable side of the same risk framework we were talking about before that needs to get developed, but whose risks are mitigatable and thus acceptable with precautions around them and with only certain people touching those experiments.
And where is this? Did they say where this thing is supposed to be housed? Because, we have DARPA. They've got Project Pele where they're looking at those mobile nuclear reactors. I just wonder, where will, because when you say Pentagon, people picture the building that you always see from the drone shot or whatever. But the Defense Department is the largest employer in the world and is an enormous agency. Where would something like this fit?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So the leadership of this entity has been assigned by Congress to the Chief Digital and AI Officer of the Defense Department. So the idea is sort of tech forward here, not policy forward, not lawyer forward, but tech forward, which makes sense given the nature of what's being asked for and the complexity of thinking through sandbox uses appropriate to DoD and then what requirements there'd be to make those secure enough to proceed. But I think it's partly on that individual and the rest of the task force to answer your good question and probably others they'll generate along the way, such as, okay, if this is to be an enduring project, certainly Congress is imagining it as an enduring project, sandbox, stand up, maintenance, security and safety maintenance. Does that live within the Undersecretary of Intelligence? Does that live within cyber? Where exactly does that live in the Defense Department? Does it stay within the Chief Digital and AI Officer who's running this task force? I suspect that will be among agenda items for discussion as this task force digs in and gets to work.
Well, and to be fair, I mean, cyber comm is different from cyber, is different from the chief AI and whatever else officer. But these seem to be, all still a little siloed. I don't hear, I haven't heard yet anything that seeks to sort of integrate all of this throughout the department. But they do mention training and development of AI, and I wanted to understand what they're talking about. Are they talking about training AI models, or are they talking about training DoD personnel in some way, or are they talking about both?
My read is both. The phrase that I think you're homing in on rightly is that the task force's stated purpose, according to the NDAA, is to identify, coordinate, and advance department-wide efforts to develop and employ AI sandbox environments necessary to support AI experimentation, training, familiarization, and development across the Department of Defense. If you read it very literally and take AI as kind of the modifier, it seems like maybe it's AI training and AI development. But a word like familiarization doesn't make that textual reading quite hold together because we're not looking to familiarize AI with things. We're trying to familiarize human beings, including our service members and civilians and others at the Department of Defense with this technology and what it can do and what it can't do so well. So I think a reasonable reading is it is both. It's a place where you can experiment for the good, so to speak, of the models. In other words, for the good of the national security interest in improving and enhancing and adapting those models for DoD purposes, but also a place where you might be able to train our war fighters and others to play with it in a way that one wouldn't feel comfortable if they're playing with a model that's actually connected to the open internet and can do things based on inputs that we might come to regret.
Horrifying. Actually, we get to section 1535, and I wonder if this is the first place that we encounter the term general AI. General AI is sort of presently an aspirational concept, and I don't know that there's a super settled agreement on this. And I do know that, like, Eric Schmidt was part of a team out of MIT that recently pumped out a paper sort of describing what it was. And it looked to me, the entire paper looked like an effort to sort of settle on a definition. What does this section 1535 create? What are the do outs that it requires?
This is another big one. This is another entity. I think this one gets the title of committee, the Artificial Intelligence Futures Steering Committee. The named participants are extremely senior members of our government. They are the Deputy Secretary of Defense. They are the Vice Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. So we're talking, and others, very senior folks. And the idea of this entity seems to think big, in terms of strategy, investments in research and development, investments in the workforce for AI and the department going forward. And you are, I think, quite right that as those responsibilities are laid out in the NDAA, Congress worked to make sure that they were underlining the notion of thinking really big, including saying, think proactively. That's the word, proactive policy about the AI yet to come, including advanced AI systems that approach or achieve artificial general intelligence. This idea, as you say, imperfectly defined, but the idea of somehow being upped in kind, not just in degree, as to what AI can perform for us, or I suppose not for us if we suffer from the alignment problem, but that it will be able to do things that kind of go above and beyond what we currently use AI for. It's an interesting and ambitious mandate. It includes, I think wisely, quite explicitly, a look not just at us, but at them. It calls on this committee to look at what adversaries, as best we can tell, are doing and are thinking of doing and are capable of doing with AI, which I think implicit, maybe somewhat explicit in the language of the NDAA, could affect our own risk calculus as to whether to deploy or not to deploy, in part because we need to think about where our adversaries are and what they might be doing, including in ways that harm our interests. So that is, in a nutshell, what this committee, this AI Future Steering Committee, is tasked to do. It must provide a report, I think, next year, early next year, to Congress, and I believe make public as much as possible its findings. So it has about a year to do this work. That report is due end of January 2027.
So their remit is to come up with a long-term strategy, recommend investments in research, which I found very interesting, workforce development, massive, which I think may be easier than we anticipate, in my view. But ethical frameworks, I see that term actually repeated quite a lot, ethical considerations, and then other emerging technologies. And I think here, things that come to mind are like quantum, maybe.
Yes.
I don't know if you have any other thoughts on that. But this seemed to me actually very thoughtful.
I agree. And just to stay on that for a minute, I mean, it's a good moment to step back and remind ourselves maybe of the somewhat strange way in which this technology is now finding itself in the hands of the Defense Department and other parts of our government and other governments. The reason I say strange is this is not like the development of the internet. It is not like the development of space travel. It is not like the development of nuclear weapons, nuclear power, all of which was driven by government, overwhelmingly by the U.S. government, but not exclusively. And then once established, became heavily regulated with private sector entry in certain respects. That's not the story of AI. The story of AI is private sector ingenuity and development. Again, quite heavily U.S. private sector. And then a sense on the part of government, among others, of this technology's there, it's available. We talked in the Biden administration about how unrealistic it would be to say, let's just develop our own. Let's just start again and try to create frontier models. I don't think government is well placed to do that. And I think it would have been a particularly frustrating exercise. Instead, the move was, how do you take commercially available models and use them appropriately, adapt them appropriately? And so that is part of, I think, what makes this look at both where the technology is going here and for our adversaries meaningful and complicated, because it's not just DoD looking at its own R&D. It's DoD understanding where the private sector, which is at the cutting edge on this technology, seems to be going, which then opens up doors and creates risk for the department.
There are aspects of this that sort of remind one of some of the rules that came down under the Eisenhower administration when Eisenhower gave that famous speech wherein he acknowledged that this was not something that the development of new military technology and defense technology was not something the government could handle, and that it needed to do so going forward in partnership with the private sector. And I'm not sure it had been as overt a concept or sort of edict until he said it aloud. And then, of course, we had this burgeoning defense industry that grew from that. I don't know what this is going to look like because I think it's slightly different. But, this prompted me to wonder what the procurement system is going to have to look like. And part of that is, unfortunately, I don't deal with this, but it seems like it's slow, it's broken, and in a lot of ways, it's just not up to purpose any longer. When you get into a technology or a phase of our existence where technology is changing at the pace it's changing, I just don't know how any of these old systems or ways of doing things are going to persist. That was sort of my takeaway as I was reading, particularly what you had written, was how is this procurement world ever going to function?
It does feel like a particular challenge in this space where there are lag times and that allow for things to become outdated particularly quickly, given the release of new models and better models. This is something that this administration, the current administration, has been particularly focused on in the AI space. When in the first month or two of the administration, it revoked a couple of OMB memoranda on AI called M memos and then reissued them as their own. There was, to my read at least, a lot of continuity between the Biden era ones and the Trump era ones. But one thing that got kind of ratcheted up, amped up in the Trump era one was the emphasis on avoiding redundancies in procurement and trying to streamline it where possible. And you see Congress kind of pick up that baton a bit in this statute. It actually is in the Intel Auth Act portion. As I mentioned before, the NDAA incorporated the Intel Authorization Act this go around, but there's a provision there specifically instructing the chief information officer and the chief AI officer of the intelligence community to try to figure out how IC elements, which sometimes share and sometimes don't, especially when it comes to procurement, don't, how they can cross-use and share and reuse, or at least reuse with minimal modification AI models, so that you don't have emerging what sometimes emerges in well-intentioned government, but based on how it's structured, you have particular elements of the intelligence community, just to give that example, with their own budgets and their own procurement officers, their own procurement pathways, going out and procuring things that their brethren in the IC are procuring at the same time in relatively similar, if not the same form. And so I think Congress is saying, look, this technology, we need to get it right. We do want the executive branch spending money on it, but ideally not wasting money on it and trying to be efficient and consolidated and coordinated more than we might have seen in other areas.
That's going to be interesting given that, these IC agencies have very different legal authorities, as defined under the National Security Act of 1948 as amended. And I just don't know how some of this will work. It's a great idea, and I hope it can occur in terms of efficiencies and sort of less money being spent. But let's talk about 6603. What is in this? Because some of the verbiage seems to align, as you pointed out, with the executive order on preventing woke AI in the federal government, et cetera. Can you talk about this a little bit and any sort of statements vis-a-vis rules of construction? What was this one all about?
I do think it's one of the more curious, maybe, provisions of the statute overall. It starts from the premise you and I were talking about before, which is that the intelligence community is not generating its own models, AI models, LLMs. It is appropriately, legally, licensing, purchasing, whatever the arrangement is, procuring the use of commercially available models. Those are the frontier models. They're the really effective ones. And for the intelligence community, that is mainly useful when they can be used in a classified environment. We spent a lot of time towards the end of the Biden administration thinking through what it meant to move a commercially available model trained on U.S. person information into the classified environment, what it meant to prompt such a model with U.S. person information or in a way that's reasonably likely to return U.S. person information. Here, I read this the particular provision you're asking about as starting from the premise that that creates a little bit of a puzzle for the intelligence community. They're taking these models that others, meaning the private sector, created, developed, trained, refined, augmented, all the things they do before the procurement stage. And then suddenly they live in this very important, very consequential space of the classified environment. And that is where Congress picks up, I think, a bit on some of the language you're mentioning from the anti-woke AI executive order that the Trump administration issued this past July, the same day that the AI action plan was issued, in which this provision suggests a need to guard against the skewing of models. It asks for testing to have performance, efficacy, safety, fairness, all of which can be quite hard to define, all of which is also admirable in the abstract, but it seems to come from the same impulse of wanting to avoid some perception of skewing or distortion via model selection or model training or model augmentation. And look, I think two things can be true at the same time. One, we do want well-tested models. If they're going to be used for consequential things in the classified environment, we do want them to be as reliable as possible. And reliable can include some of the features that this provision identifies, like transparent and trustworthy. At the same time, it really takes care to define what one means by that, especially for probabilistic things, right? These models are probabilistic in nature. You could ask it the same prompt and it could bring back a different response 5 minutes later. And what it means to really, in a sophisticated, nuanced way, test those and understand whether they are skewed or simply imperfect and still developing and fundamentally probabilistic requires some real technological know-how. So I get the impetus here, but I think those in the intelligence community will have to figure out a lot in actually implementing this.
I guess I thought they were grafting on concepts of LLMs onto other kinds of AI models. So when they talked about truth-seeking, ideologically neutral, I mean, that really would apply to like ChatGPT or something. To me, that is a concept that sort of misapprehends what defense systems do. And I feel like it was just grafted on here and it struck me as a bit maybe gratuitous.
I think you're right. You know, we all are carrying around, maybe even my answer betrayed this bias on my part. We're carrying around chatbots in our heads as the paradigm of AI right now, in part because they're really widespread in their use, remarkably so, given that they didn't really exist in the current form a decade ago. And they're quite useful and good. But you are right that that is not all that AI can do, let alone all that AI might be most useful for in the DoD and intelligence community context. And what it means not to be, you know, ideologically biased when the goal of an AI system is to refine Patriot interceptor arcs of flight is a lot less clear and really hard to probably articulate versus what it means in a sort of a chatbot context. I think that's a good point you're making.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.